Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Chris Hutton. Let's get into the news of today. And the first thing I want to talk about is a little bit of an opinion piece put up on our website, thedailyfriend.co.za, by one of our regulars on the podcast, Terence Corrigan. And it's titled, "The GNU Fails Its First Test." Now, that's quite ominous, but I think Terence makes a pretty interesting point here. He talks a little bit about the appointment of Dr. John Hlophe, former judge in the Western Cape, former senior judge in the Western Cape, who was one of the first judges in South African history to be impeached from his position, being appointed to the Judicial Services Commission in Parliament, which helps to pick the judges. As Terence says, that he is now presiding over the appointment of judges is bizarre, that he is doing so on behalf of a party that rejects the very constitutional order that the judiciary is meant to oversee and protect is, to my mind, obscene. He, however, points out, very importantly, that this would not have been possible without the support of the ANC. So there was a division amongst the Government of National Unity members in what they voted, in how they voted on the formation of the Judicial Services Commission makeup. Some parties, such as the Democratic Alliance and the African Christian Democratic Party, voted against including Hlophe on that Judicial Services Commission. Now, I've heard from an MP that apparently the ANC's leadership considered voting against Hlophe, but ultimately they were not keen to do so because they feared that some people in their own caucus might vote for him, and then they run the risk of either losing a vote very embarrassingly from a split caucus or just having some sort of split, which would be disastrous for the ANC's obsession with party unity. So I think Terence is very correct to point out, of course, that this is a failure of the GNU because, you know, the point of having a government of national unity of parties that are, shall we say, more constitutionalist in their outlook is that they're supposed to prevent this kind of stuff. But Chris, what do you make of this case? To me, this does show, I think, that the ANC remains internally very divided and very unsure of its path forward in the national political landscape.
Yeah, I think it's a very astute point by Terence. Whether that indicates that the GNU itself has failed its first test or whether there is still a lot to be decided, as it were, I think is a different question. So keep in mind, the ANC dropped in this election cycle by 17 percentage points, dropped from the highest point of 69% in 2004 now to just under 40%. What that means in terms of one's maybe belief in your policies, your ideology, your leadership for various people within the ANC, within the wider structures, it remains still the biggest party. But I think for many, they'll be questioning the direction of travel. And that makes things quite uncertain as to where things might fall. So if you're part of the leadership, it's not a good sign of your leadership or how maybe much you trust your colleagues and how coherent a political party you are. But I think that's a reality for the ANC at this point in time. That's not to say it can't now, as it were, shift in one direction or the other. But I think we shouldn't be surprised if more and more factionalism maybe becomes a reality. And it's not to say factionalism in terms of different views on property rights or it's Ramaphosa's ANC versus Mashatile's ANC. Maybe more around things like patronage, influence. Is it better for the party electorally to take the route that the provincial ANC is pursuing in Gauteng? Much more around, I think, pure power politics than anything else. And that will continue to shake out in ways that maybe we can predict in some ways and other ways that are quite unexpected. So there are opportunities for the other partners like the DA, the IFP, maybe to try and now work with their GNU colleagues in different ways, different departments, also in the civil service, in the public sector, in the SOEs, to try and change thinking, change ideas, expose people to better ways of doing things. And I'm not saying it's an easy task, but that could well come about. It's a much more longer-term achievement. But for now, I think Terence is exactly right to point out when these sorts of things occur, if this new government really is saying it's going to be different, it's trying to buck the trends of what came before. In this particular regard, for the ANC specifically, not necessarily the case.
Yeah, and this is, I think, clearly the strategy of the EFF and MK going forward, is that they've already been cooperating quite closely in Parliament with each other, supporting each other as much as they can. And I think that they are adopting a strategy of trying to pull the ANC away from the government of national unity and kind of pull it into a sort of ideological space that it's traditionally been much more comfortable in. Sort of, on one hand, putting the carrot of saying, hey, you know, we're from the same background as you. You know, we were all ANC once. Come on, you know, join us. Why are you being mean to Hlophe? He was, you know, he was a loyal cadre, and look how you treated him. And at the other, and on the other hand, also saying, oh, you see, you're selling out to the whites, you're selling out to the capitalists, you're selling out to the whatever the boogeyman they want to come up with is. And the ANC, I think, at the moment, its national leadership is resisting those sort of calls. I think Fikile Mbalula and Cyril Ramaphosa seem to be pushing back against that, at least in their actions, if not necessarily in their rhetoric. But it's clear that there are still a lot of people in the senior ranks of the ANC who are very sympathetic to those parties. And so the battle for the sort of soul of the ANC, I think, has not even really fully begun. It's still sort of simmering away in the background. Okay, let's move on to our next story, and this is about the devolution of powers with regards to trains and infrastructure. So Minister of Transport Barbara Creasy has dismissed calls to devolve power regarding South Africa's passenger rail agency to each province, or at least wholesale devolution. She's kind of continuing the ANC policy of keeping things fairly centralized. She said that it was against international practice to devolve passenger rail lines too much, and that South Africa did not need 9 passes, one for each province. However, she did say that there is a draft devolution strategy, and they should be allowing metros and provinces to have more say over transport planning. So there's at least, I think, a little bit of a shift there in terms of policy, even if it's not one as much as, say, for example, the DA might like, because they've been calling very specifically for the devolution of power with regards to train services, because I know the DA says that it could make improvements to the passenger rail network in the Western Cape if they had more ability to control it. Chris, what do you make of this? What do you make of Creasy's statements?
So on the one hand, if you take the more, I guess, cynical interpretation, it's just a continued unwillingness to realize the reality of an entity like PRASA, like Transnet, Eskom and others, where the concentration risk of an SOE is just so high. If it fails, it affects the whole economy. Whereas if you have competition amongst the provinces, if you have private sector players and public sector players, then at least there's an incentive for better service delivery, lower prices, competitive behavior and perks on the part of different players within that entity. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, you could have this where the direction of travel is ultimately to where there is some element of devolution, but you can't, well, not can't, but if you try and do it wholesale, the amount of pushback and kicking against it is just going to subvert the whole process throughout. So you try and do it in a longer term roundabout way. That doesn't, of course, fix things right now. And for the majority of South Africans who rely, for example, on minibus taxis to get to work, having functional passenger rail would go so far in terms of unlocking more economic activity, where people have to spend what little money they do earn on transport to get to work, when fuel prices increase, et cetera, et cetera. If you could use trains, trams, that kind of thing, that would just save many people a lot more money and get economic activity going to a more substantial level. So I wonder if it falls into one of those two camps. That might be a bit too reductionist on my part. But I wonder if there is at least some element of realization, this is where we need to go. And once the train, if you'll pardon the metaphor, has pulled out of the station, you can't get it back in. So that will then be the overall direction. Yes, there will be issues along the way, but maybe this is a longer-term strategic way to deal with this particular area of structural reform.
Chris, you did sort of try to talk up a little bit the progress that she says that PRASA has made recently in recovering from the infrastructure destruction that it faced during the lockdowns, where she said that they are continuing to reopen passenger rail lines across the country, with now 28 out of 40 priority lines being fully operational. To me, that strikes me as a bit of a low bar for one to pat oneself on the back for, but you know, progress is progress, I suppose. Yeah. And the last thing we're going to talk about quickly today is South Africa's interest rate. And there are suggestions from analysis at the Bank of America that we may be headed for an interest rate cut, at least maybe even two later this year. The Bank of America suggests that this is dependent a lot on what the United States Federal Reserve does with regards to its interest rates, as those have a big impact on how our Reserve Bank sets its interest rates. But their analysis said if the Fed were to initiate the cutting cycle as early as September, we would see two South African Reserve Bank cuts in September and November. Chris, what does this mean for us mere mortals?
So basically, should interest rates be cut, you'll see lending rates come down, borrowing rates on the part of banks. If you've got mortgage commitments, credit commitments, your repayments on those will be less. So for those who maybe just before COVID, during COVID, committed to very flashy cars and big homes, it'll help them a little bit. But more importantly, for people who are dependent on your consumables, your perishable goods, your basic foodstuffs, there you have the possibility where it opens up more breathing room for businesses to engage in loans. They can engage in more substantial economic activity because they're more confident they can repay what they do take from banks if they do need that form of assistance. Over time, I think it just lowers economic pressures quite a bit. On the other hand, if you cut too soon and consumer spending takes off, but it's not coupled with an actual uptick in real economic activity, then you've got the issue around hyperinflation, where there's more money chasing fewer goods in the economy. So on the one hand, I think the Reserve Bank, I think, doing quite well to wait for now. It's quite painful. But should the Fed especially start to cut rates, then I do think the Reserve Bank will follow suit. We have seen food prices stabilize somewhat in South Africa in the first half. The agricultural sector performed better than many had thought initially, especially in hotter weather this year than had been the case in some years prior. The latter half of this year should hopefully bring more rainfall, which is better for our farmers. So overall, I think there are particularly good signs around that. That being said, of course, the structural drivers around higher inflation, things like the ports, it looks like electricity, there is a bit of a handle on that now, but the ports, labor regulations, those sorts of issues, the longer they remain the case, inflation can only come down so much if the other things remain the same.
Yeah, no, we definitely do not want a continuation of inflation that we've had over the past couple of years. I'm sure everyone agrees with that, from the rich to the poor. It's been very unpleasant. So whatever the Reserve Bank does, I hope it does it wisely. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We hope that you found this show interesting. That's a wrap for today.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.